This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Uhuru Movement gets its own FM radio station in St. Petersburg, Florida, and the rebellion in Baltimore is having lasting effects. The city's mayor says she won't run for re-election. But first, the U.S. Justice Department announced that it will begin to focus on prosecuting individual corporate executives for crimes, rather than just fining their corporations. But Russell Mokyber, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, says the Obama administration is just blowing hot air and nothing has really changed. Big banks and other corporations and their top officers are still too big to jail.
When we started Corporate Crime Reporter 30 years ago, when the Justice Department came across evidence of criminal wrongdoing by a corporation, they would criminally prosecute the corporation and either secure a guilty plea or go to trial. About 20 years ago, this changed under pressure from what might be called the corporate crime lobby. The hundreds of corporate lawyers and lobbyists in Washington who are seeking to control the agenda. And the shift was to something called deferred and non-prosecution agreements. People on the street know this as where you commit a first offense, a minor offense, some minor drug crime. The prosecutor will say to you, listen, we're going to charge you with this crime, but if you're a good boy or girl and don't do anything wrong for a year, we'll drop it and your record will be clear. It was intended to clear the courts and the prisons of minor first-time offenders. But the corporate criminal defense lawyers picked it up. And now it's the MO for corporate criminal settlements in Washington, New York, around the country. The Justice Department was under so much heat for this kind of behavior and for not criminally prosecuting one major financial institution or one executive from those financial institutions for the criminality that led to the 2008 financial collapse. It was taking so much incoming from the failure to criminally prosecute those responsible for that, that it decided it had to do something. And what it did this week is released a memo saying, basically codifying what Justice Department policy is anyway. Nothing new, as one law professor at the University of Michigan put it yesterday, who was a former head prosecutor at the Justice Department, David Ellman. Where's the beef? It's not in this memo. Basically, it says, if you cooperate with us by turning over information about those within the institution who have engaged in criminality, you will get cooperation credit. Nothing new, except they made a big deal about it, and some members of the press bought it hook, line, and sinker. So you heard yesterday reports that the Justice Department is now going to crack down on corporate crime. Don't believe the hype. In fact, if they were going to crack down on corporate crime, they would have put out a memo reversing Eric Holder's memo from 20 years ago that opened the floodgates to these deferred non-prosecution agreements. And they would have said, no longer for major corporate crimes, which these are, will we allow our prosecutors to enter into deferred and non-prosecution agreements. Instead, we will insist on guilty pleas, probation, and change of corporate culture. And also, we will criminally prosecute individual executives who are responsible for those crimes. But instead, they released this PR memo to try and divert attention from the reality on the ground.
So by codifying, in fact, what has been past policy, one could interpret that as a hardening of the position, that is, putting it in writing.
Absolutely. There's no effective change. There's a rhetorical change. But the reality is when I've interviewed scores of corporate criminal defense attorneys, they like Corporate Crime Reporter. They like to read it because they want to know what's going on. And we report on the details of Justice Department policy. And to a person, what they will tell you is the one thing that they fear the most, the corporations and their lawyers, is a criminal guilty plea. because that hits them in their reputation. That hits them in the market. To be known as a corporate criminal hurts them. They don't want to accept it. What they're willing to accept, to pay the criminal fine, no problem. To turn over low-level, mid-level executives who engaged in the wrongdoing, they'll throw them under the bus. To even appoint a monitor, if they get to approve the monitor, to report back to the government over that period of 2 years or however long the deferred non-prosecution agreement lasts. No problem. But we're not going to admit wrongdoing. This is also policy not just at the Justice Department, but for years at the Securities and Exchange Commission, where the SEC brings the charges of securities fraud against these companies. And the companies pay these fines, but neither admit nor deny violating the law and agree never to violate the law again. That's actually the actual wording of these consent decrees. So we have to move from a system where we send a green light to corporate criminals, say, don't worry, if you engage in this criminal wrongdoing, you have the lawyers in Washington, you'll get the deferred non-prosecution agreements, the neither admit nor deny SEC consent decrees. We will not hold your feet to the fire. We have to change that and just return to a policy that, like it used to be. If you engage in criminal wrongdoing, we will force you to admit guilt or take you to trial.
This sounds like encouragement, a blank check for criminal business enterprises.
Right, and what you see is that the reason for that is a couple of reasons. One, tight budgets, because it takes a lot of lawyers, a lot of resources to criminally prosecute these companies, and they're being squeezed because post 9/11, the money was shifted from corporate and white collar crime prosecutions to terrorism prosecutions. And second, the revolving door. People like Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer, working for the big corporate law firms, then going to positions of power at the Justice Department, then returning to the corporate law firms. I mean, the head of Covington & Burling, where Eric Holder was before he became Attorney General, they just built a new building in Washington, and they had an office for him while he was Attorney General, waiting for him to return. He had a place to go to represent those he was supposed to be prosecuting while he was at the Justice Department. So it's an insidious system that prevents and undermines justice.
The reason I brought up criminal enterprises is because this is so different than how law enforcement deals with operations that they designate as criminal enterprises, in which they go after the smaller guys and turn them, hoping to send the big guys to jail for a long time.
Correct. The double standard is stark between how people on the street are treated and how people inside the Beltway are treated and those in the executive suite. And we need a real grassroots movement for justice in this country to both relieve the pressure on the street and bring justice to those in powerful positions who are engaging in wrongdoing. Now, when we talk about corporate crime, by the way, Glenn, we're talking about instances that actually injure and kill. We just published an article in Corporate Crime Reporter titled "Corporations Commit the Crime and You Do the Time." And it's about these cases where companies are producing defective automobiles. And for example, the Jeep Cherokee of a certain year in the 90s and 2000s, where the gas tank was behind the rear axle. And what's happening is, in these kinds of cars and others, someone will be driving along and there'll be a fender bender. Let's say you're driving behind one of these Jeep Cherokees. There's a fender bender, as happened in a case in Georgia. And the young 4-year-old in the backseat of the Jeep Cherokee survived the collision, but gas was spilled after the gas tank was crushed, caught on fire, and the boy was incinerated to death. The driver of the car behind the Jeep Cherokee was sent to prison for 15 years for vehicular manslaughter, but there was no criminal prosecution of Chrysler for placing that tank behind the rear axle. 70 people have been incinerated to death as a result of that kind of accident for those Jeep Cherokees. And there's calls on prosecutors to bring homicide charges against Chrysler. I think it's now Fiat Chrysler for those deaths. The last time an automobile company was prosecuted for homicide was the Ford Motor Company, when 3 teenage girls were incinerated in a similar accident in Indiana. company was found not guilty, but a Republican conservative prosecutor in Northern Indiana brought that case more than 20 years ago. But it's not just that. I think there have been three cases now where people have spent time in jail for vehicular manslaughter, have been released after it was revealed that the people who they were sent to jail for killing were actually put in harm's way, not primarily by their recklessness, but by the defect in the automobile. And so this is now a movement among people who are in jail in these vehicular homicide cases to get out. Because, like, for example, in that Chrysler case, the parents of that young boy sued Chrysler and recovered $150 million in Georgia. And the jury found that Chrysler was 99% responsible and the driver of the vehicle was only 1% responsible. And yet the driver of the vehicle went to jail and the company was never criminally prosecuted.
And of course, big banks kill too, and probably a lot more people. They kill whole economies and create chaos in vast stretches of the country.
Well, yeah, I mean, the damage that was done by the financial crisis, which many people should feel there should have been criminal prosecutions for, you really can't put a number on it. It's, you know, basically tanked the economy for a number of years, caused misery and death, and dollar numbers just don't make sense when you're dealing with that kind of criminality. But yeah, this is now in focus, and I'm a little concerned that our brothers and sisters in the media are reporting that the Justice Department has now turned its eye to crack down on corporate crime, I think the way USA Today put it, when in fact it might just be a diversion from the reality on the ground.
And I think you've been saying that the corporate lawyers that you talk to aren't much worried about this because they understand that the law or the practice of it has not changed.
Well, they think the practice will change because of the emphasis on going after individuals. But they realize that, you know, one way you can tell what's going on is look at the names of the lawyers and who's representing whom in these cases. If it's a big major American law firm, you know they're representing the company and they're going to be willing to throw a few executives under the bus. But they're not going to be willing to throw the people who are hiring them under the bus. Those are the people in the C-suite, in the corporate suite, the CEO, the board of directors, the chief executives, and the vice presidents. They're not going to say, hey, take me, I did it. They're going to say, fight this thing to the end and make sure we don't have to plead guilty. For one level of executive, this might change the game, but for another level of executive, it's not going to.
That was Russell Mokyber of the Corporate Crime Reporter. The mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, says she will not run for re-election next year. Last week, her administration announced it will pay the family of Freddie Gray $6.4 million as a settlement for his death in police custody. Also last week, a judge rejected a bid by the lawyers for the six police officers charged in Freddie Gray's death that their trial be moved to another jurisdiction. We spoke with Jill Carter, a young Baltimore lawyer who's widely considered to be the most radical member of the Maryland State Legislature. Delegate Carter is from an activist family. She's run unsuccessfully for mayor of Baltimore and may run again. Carter believes the rebellion over Freddie Gray's death and constant pressures from protesters finally broke the current mayor's will to continue in office.
I definitely think this decision was largely due to the stress of the last number of months and the lack of confidence that had been expressed across the board in the mayor. You know, there's social media, Facebook groups, resign, Stephanie Rawlings Blake. I mean, there's been a lot of backlash against her. And I believe polling indicates that she was going to have a tough time getting reelected. So it's been suggested that perhaps the $6.4 million settlement results in one or some of her donors backing off and saying, we can't go for that. So I don't know. It's anyone's guess what the real motivation was, but I can say that she appeared to be extremely irritated by the questions and challenges to her decision-making throughout this entire process. She appeared to be very rattled and kind of off balance in the course of having to answer to the people about the decisions that were being made.
If the project of these establishment politicians like the mayor is to continue the process of gentrification in Baltimore, I suppose that the rebellions, which might set back that process, could be considered a failure of that kind of politician and that mayor and that administration.
That would certainly be great if it is the truth, if it's the case. And I think here we are now, faced with elections next year, top to bottom, and many of us are urging and hoping that the movement for justice with policing and justice with Freddie Gray will turn into a political change movement, a political reform movement. And certainly some of that is in the works, so we can only hope and hopefully lead the way for that to be the case. And I think that's something that we have an opportunity here, unless we've had in recent years, to really, really change that direction. So I'm hopeful that her stepping down is only one part of the issue. The bigger issue is, will we allow someone else similar to take control of that office? And there's a lot of speculation of what's perceived as an outsider coming in, being heavily funded, and taking control of the city, and that would be a disaster.
You have made a run for mayor in the past. Has anything happened in the last several months or even today that would make you re-enter that kind of contest?
I've been contemplating it, and I've been meeting with a lot of organizations and groups and stressing the point that exactly what, you know, I'm alluding to. I won't run a campaign under the same structure that is typical or traditional, you know, where I have to look to the four or five typical donors to fund a campaign, and then I go around and explain to the people why they should vote for me. It's got to be a people's campaign. The people have to be on the ground with a reform platform, and we have to run together in order for me to run for mayor. And that's what I've been stressing to people. To do anything else is the politics as usual that we need to get away from. And I think we could actually set an example for the kind of political reform that could happen and should happen in a lot of cities throughout the country. And I'm excited about the opportunity, but also a little hesitant, because I think that if we miss the mark on this one, we miss it for a very, very long time to come, maybe possibly, you know, forever.
The judge in Baltimore just last week decided that the trial of the six police officers would be held in Baltimore, that there would not be a change of venue. In doing so, do you think he prevented another Simi Valley verdict, that is, like the verdict in 1992 that exonerated the police officers in the Rodney King beating?
I don't necessarily believe so. I think it was the right decision, of course, to keep it here where all stakeholders are. I think it would be preposterous to think that moving it to another jurisdiction is going to find a jury pool that's unbiased or untainted by the publicity or forming a perception about the case in advance. But the issue is this. Baltimore City juries are not monolithic. You know, we're not monolithic people or monolithic juries, and they come from the voter and motor roll, which tend to be, you know, often you go into circuit court and you find they're not all black juries. Many juries, you know, break down almost to half and half, black and white, many older people. They don't necessarily all carry the views of many people that have stood up in protest against police brutality. So what I guess I'm saying, all of that to say, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that because it's in Baltimore, the officers will be convicted, which means that it's anyone's guess whether or not there will be future uprisings and continued protests. I suspect there will be. I suspect that there will be. It's been heavily speculated that officers have not been charged as seriously as they should. No one is charged with first-degree murder. And the case is somewhat limited to the time that Freddie Gray was in the police van. No charges ensued from prior to the ban when he was first accosted and first assaulted by police officers. And so, again, I think we have to watch and see how it plays out, but I definitely don't believe that because the trial is happening here where it should happen, that it's a foregone conclusion that the officer will be convicted.
But with the trial happening in Baltimore, it may be a foregone conclusion that the trial will affect the political alignment for the upcoming mayor's race.
Absolutely. And, you know, that actually could have very well been a factor in the mayor's decision not to run for re-election, having to to have that constant reminder of what's perceived as a failing of the city to address not only the uprising and the aftermath of the uprising, but to prevent an uprising by instituting more just policies. And I can tell you that from all indications, just yesterday there was the pretrial motion for change of venue, and there was protesting, peaceful protesting, prior to that decision outside of the courthouse, and a couple of people were arrested, and the protesters all indicated that the new police commissioner and the police department was clearly implementing a zero-tolerance policy yesterday for protesters. And so there will continue to be that kind of conflict between people and police throughout this entire process if that is the way that they are going to continue to operate, and it appears they are.
You, of course, are a member of the Maryland House of Delegates, but you're also a veteran lawyer and trial lawyer. How long can this legal proceeding be expected to last?
Well, interestingly enough, it already seems to be sort of fast-tracked, because the normal case of criminal defense trials that involve six different co-defendants usually played out over a long period of time in Baltimore City. Rarely do you see a trial for a serious felony charge within a year of the time that there's a charge or that there's an indictment or an arraignment. And so it appears that they're moving on a fast track, but the fact that the trials are separated into six different trials indicates it's probably going to go on for the better part of the next 2 years, in my opinion.
There are a number of people who have already stated their intention to run for mayor, and one of the people who has not declared but is expected to do so is the husband. He's a city council member, the husband of the prosecutor who brought the charges against those six policemen.
I think Nick Mosby is likely to run for mayor. I really believe he probably wouldn't run until today because he'd give up his seat. He's not that widely known himself, but of course the Mosby name is now popular and he's got more notoriety because of his wife. He's only a one-term council person, so he doesn't have much of a record at all yet. But the fact that Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake's top fundraiser, Colleen Martin Lauer, who was also O'Malley's fundraiser and a top fundraiser for the Democrat machine here some months ago, left Stephanie Rawlings Blake and became Nick Mosby's fundraiser, caused a lot of people to speculate that he would likely run. And so I think that he probably will. It remains to be seen how his relationship with Marilyn Mosby, the state attorney, his marriage is going to play out. There are a lot of people who believe and have already voiced their belief that it's a conflict of interest and that he's sort of riding on her coattails, but hasn't done anything himself to actually warrant his being elevated to the position of mayor. I think he'll be heavily funded because of the fundraiser that he has, but I'm not sure that he will resonate more than any other candidate.
Well, Delegate Carter, one of the things that makes you stand out as a political figure is you consistently talk about the funders as the real powers behind these little municipal thrones in Baltimore and elsewhere.
Well, because that's true. I've even seen it play out already in this mayor's race, this upcoming mayor's race, where many of the candidates that are already in office, actually some of them have even come and sat down with me and they've told me, you know, to ask if I'm going to run and then to tell me that they've already got financial commitments. And the commitments come from largely John Patarakis, the owner of H&M Bakery here, Peter Angelos, and people of that ilk. You know, there's a small handful of people such as that donate heavily to all of the candidates' campaigns and then thus control the policies and the politics of the city. And so every single one of the other potential candidates outside of myself has and will be funded in that same manner, which means that they could have a different face, a different hairstyle, but they're all going to bring essentially the same policies that have always been in place, which is no change at all, no reform at all. And so I guess I'm not impressed, and I don't think that the people in large masses are impressed. The only group of people that is interested in any of the candidates that have so thus far announced are people that are very invested in politics as usual in the city.
So when folks refer to Baltimore as a black controlled and run city, it ain't necessarily so.
Oh no, we have black people that hold positions, but the real power behind those positions is the money and the structures. You know, we also have these structures in place, such as the Greater Baltimore Committee, the Baltimore Development Corporation. Some refer to them as somewhat of a shadow government, but basically they dictate, direct, and determine the direction of the city, who and what gets opportunities, what development deals will happen. You know, basically they dictate who will be the haves and the have-nots.
And so now I'm going to return to my original question. What effect will the rebellion have had on the ongoing project of development, another word for gentrification of this majority black city?
Well, I'm hoping that the rebellion is the first step in the direction of changing the politics of the city. And some of us are looking at changing that kind of rebellion into complete political reform. We have to take advantage of the opportunity while people are awake and motivated to do something. We either succeed in this direction or we fail miserably, and we fail for a very long time to come.
And could it be that the developers have lost confidence in the mayor, prompting her not to run again?
Oh, I definitely believe that's likely. That's probably one of the motivations. I think it's more likely that the mayor received indications that she was not going to have all of the backing that she initially has had, and it might be distributed amongst the other group of similar politicians with similar ideologies and philosophies. But I definitely believe that the motivation was more likely the lack of confidence from the money people, the developers, than it really was that she wanted to focus on governing the city.
Jill Carter, a member of the Maryland House of Delegates, speaking from Baltimore. Black Agenda Report contributing editor Danny Haifong draws moral and political inspiration from the late George Jackson, the San Quentin prison inmate who became a leader of the Black Panther Party and was killed by prison guards in August of 1971. Haifong is author of an article in this week's issue of BAR titled, Why George Jackson Matters. Haifong is an activist with FIST, Fight Imperialism, Stand Together, in Boston, and has worked closely with local members of the Black Lives Matter organization.
When Black Lives Matter Boston came onto the scene, there was a lot of excitement and a lot of hope. There was demonstrations happening almost, it seemed, weekly around the murder of Eric Garner and Michael Brown, and that happened relatively close to each other. But there has been consistently a missing piece to this organizing that I talk extensively about in my article this week about George Jackson, entitled Why George Jackson Matters Through the Lens of What Am I? And what has been missing from my observations and from my work with FIST and with the Workers' World Party that supports it, what has been missing is an ideological lens and a guide that movements require in order to really force the system of imperialism and white supremacy to expose the contradictions of the system and what really educates in a mass way oppressed people and working class people generally. So that has been what has been missing. There has been a lot of excitement over the last year or so about this movement nationally. In Boston, Black lives have never mattered, and it has been historically, over the last 30 or 40 years, a difficult time in Boston and the surrounding area because what we call the mass Black incarceration state and the Black leadership class have a firm grip on the political development and organization of oppressed people, especially Black people in the city. So in my article about George Jackson, I write about how he stressed throughout his time in prison, which he spent 10 years, 7.5 in solitary confinement, sleeping in his own filth. Yet he wrote so much that guides us today and should guide us today. Internationalism, understanding that the struggle for liberation of Black people and all oppressed people anywhere is fundamentally rooted in the global struggle against imperialism. He also has a foundational theory in his text, Blood in My Eye, on the prison state, the mass Black incarceration state we analyze and organize against so much at Black and Gender Report. His theory is rooted in the repression of the Black Panther Party when he was organizing in prison. And it's also rooted in an understanding that prison is a social control mechanism of oppressed people and working class people in this empire. And he was experiencing both of those as he was struggling against the prison state during his time. So there's so much to learn from him. And I think from my observations here, the Black Lives Matter movement has been an exciting time, but it has not developed into the movement that I think a lot of us more radical folks are looking for. And, you know, we still have lots of work to do in terms of how do we relate to this movement and how do we move forward in this struggle as this incipient development either dies out or changes over time.
Well, when you speak about this deficit in terms of ideology, do you mean that activists are not schooled in political theory or that they are hostile to it?
I think that, you know, in this period, my experience in Boston and you know, anywhere I've been organizing, I think in this period in particular, what George Jackson calls fascism in Blood in My Eye, which he defines as the development, a certain mode of development in imperialism where no alternative is allowed to develop, no legitimate resistance is allowed to stand, repression in all of its forms will be brought down upon it. And what I see today is that, you know, there are few students of revolutionary political thought among organizing communities here in Boston. But even more so, I think there is a fear and a relative hostility to the ideas of socialism, to the idea of Black liberation movement. And I also think that there's an aversion to history. George Jackson, you know, in my article, I talk about how he was a student of history, how important this was for him and for the Black liberation movement as a whole to be able to understand the context and the history of the system that they were fighting. And today, what I see as a huge issue and what I think we're all trying to figure out is how do we approach history in this time and how do we introduce revolutionary political thought back into the struggle for liberation that at this point is in a period of retraction in this country, despite the Black Lives Matter development and despite the Occupy movement before that. I still see an aversion to organizing on an ideological basis where the issues that we are addressing are placed in the context of a ruling system that is heavily steeped in entrenched in white supremacy, capitalism, and the ruling class that controls both.
From your observations and your interactions, what are activists, including Black Lives Matter activists, but others as well, what are they doing right in this period, and what do you think they're doing wrong?
You know, in my opinion, I think what is right about this incipient development is the obvious fact that police brutality and white supremacy are central and core issues that will inform any revolutionary struggle from now until the last days that the system exists here in this empire as well as all over the world. But, you know, also I think what has been done right is the sheer call out of this issue and the use of various direct actions to bring attention to it. I think that was a natural development, and you know, that is how in this period with the class and anti-racist struggle being where it is, that was how it was going to happen. So there's no, that could not be incorrect. But in terms of what I think, you know, is needed at this time is for actual demands and an actual movement to develop among more advanced elements within the incipient Black Lives Matter development, but also among the left generally. I think what needs to happen is more things like the Black Is Back Coalition conference and more conferences and more attempts to unite based on common principles and somehow figuring out how to bring back and revive revolutionary ideas that are by no means repressed all over the world, but in the United States and in the Western imperialist countries, they are far remote and too remote in the organization of much of the left. And I think that has to do with many developments that we have to address, we have to put into the political conversation, whether that is the mass black incarceration state or the rapid development of global capital and how it has disorganized our forces over the last 40 years. These are conversations that we need to have, and as well as why the anti-imperialist movement is in the state that it is in. I think in terms of what this movement needs to do overall in this country is to go back into history, read people like George Jackson, study those that he was studying, and start to articulate a historical as well as a contemporary narrative that can more realistically and more attractively approach oppressed people where they are at and figure out programs and forms of organization like revolutionaries in the past have done that can bring people into the struggle rather than push them away, which is what I think certain tactics such as pleading to politicians to come out with a racial justice program, I see that as having potential to push people away from movement building, especially when the disappointing fact of the matter is that these imperialist politicians will only give us more of the same that we have seen over the last 30 years. And if we talk about the system generally over the last couple of centuries.
You're an organizer with a group called Fight Imperialism, Stand Together, FIST, but the word, the very word imperialism is not one that falls trippingly from the tongues of even lots of people who are activists.
No, imperialism is a remote term in much of the political conversation that happens in Boston as well as all over the country. And, you know, imperialism is a theoretical understanding as well as a political understanding of power and how power manifests itself through the ruling system that we all experience every day. Imperialism is central, and I argue the most important term that we need to wrap our heads around at this moment because it defines everything that occurs, whether that is the wars that the U.S. and its allies are waging abroad in Syria and Libya and all over North Africa and the Middle East, creating this refugee crisis that it cannot possibly contain. But also when we talk about the mass black incarceration state, we are talking about a mechanism of control that is so ballooned and bloated that it outstretches and beats up the entire planet in terms of the number of black people in prisons. But imperialism is really a system that holds the answer to the question as to why. And the why is that we live under a capitalist system that has developed and monopolized to the point where corporations and its rulers have deemed certain people and certain classes of people expendable. Black people have been deemed one of those populations. And we cannot understand why that is or why, for example, Pelican Bay prisoners can be put into solitary confinement for reading George Jackson if we don't understand imperialism. So there's so much to the question of imperialism, but to understand it as a system of monopoly capital that, as George Jackson would say, reached the point of fascism, if we don't ask what that system is and we don't present the imperialist system as the central question to the struggle today, then we're not really going anywhere.
So I guess you're saying if you don't understand the nature of imperialism, then you might think that body cameras will solve the problem with police.
Exactly. Imperialism is really understanding of the state, and it's really understanding who the state is controlled by, why the state does what it does, and how the political economy, the question of who profits, why profits are accumulated the way they are, and why entire nations are subjected to neocolonialism and constant war because of the state of imperialism, then we cannot say that people, especially oppressed people, will not be misled or coerced, as the state does, into believing that certain reforms or certain changes under this system are possible or even probable in this period.
That was Danny Haifong, a contributing writer for Black Agenda Report. The Uhuru movement will soon have its own radio station. The African People's Socialist Party, commonly known as the Uhuru Movement, won permission to operate a low-power FM station in St. Petersburg, Florida, the site of their party headquarters. Chairman Omali Yeshitela says a fundraiser will begin this weekend to raise money to put the station in operation. We asked Yeshitela what the Uhuru Movement will bring to the airwaves.
Well, one thing that's going to be new about it is it's going to be the only black-owned radio station in the city, the only one that's been here for a very long time. And the other thing that's going to be new about it is going to be a community-supported radio station, which means that we won't have to rely on the traditional ad sales and what have you in order to function, which means that there will be a greater degree of independence that the station will have, which means that we can really do some things to forward the interests of the African community, as opposed to being concerned about worrying some advertiser, some corporation that won't like what it is we're going to be seeing.
The first question I think that would be in most people's minds is, how would the Uhuru Movement, the African People's Socialist Party, how did it happen that you guys got a license for a low-power FM station?
You know, there's been a lot of pressure on the FCC that has hogged all of the airwaves for the major corporations. And I think this has been going on for some time from an assortment of different forces with different kinds of political interests. And I think as a concession to people and groups that have been complaining about the fact that the corporations own the airways, the FCC opened the door for a small number of low-power FM stations to be granted to forces that could meet certain kinds of requirements. And because the African People's Education and Defense Fund, which is the owner of the station, is part of the Uhuru Movement, and because it is a very well organized entity, the African People's Education Defense Fund got in and into the process, fought in a very serious and organized and persistent way. We made them an offer they couldn't refuse.
This weekend you're having an event at the Uhuru House in St. Petersburg. It's a very impressive facility, but that event is designed to raise money. Where will the money go to?
Well, the money is going to be going to the radio station. We have the station license. We've got the building where it's going to be located. We've got much of the space organized for the radio station. And now what we have to do is get equipment. We've got to get antennas and transmitters and an assortment of equipment to actually put on the ground here. And so on the 20th of this month, we having a major kind of rollout. And the objective here, as you just mentioned, is to raise money. We have to raise a minimum of $50,000 over the period between now and early next year when we intend to actually begin broadcasting. We have to raise a minimum of $50,000. And so this is going to be the kickoff here on September 20th at the Uhuru House in St. Petersburg, Florida. And you, Glenn, we're happy to say, agreed to participate in making that happen by providing us with your presence along with New York State Assemblyman Charles Barron, who will also be here. And I really appreciate the fact that the two of you can see the significance of an independent FM radio station, black radio station, in terms of advancing just the cause of our people, generally speaking.
If you don't raise the $50,000 in the allotted time period, does the permission lapse?
Well, we have about an 18-month time frame after the license was provided to us within which we have to begin broadcasting. So it is very serious that we raise this money. And we intend to be broadcasting early next year. So our objective is to get the money, and hopefully we can get the support from even people who are listening to this discussion, and certainly from the community here, because that's going to be critical, winning the support of the local community. And we've initiated a campaign where we're going door to door, talking to people, and even asking people to make contributions, whatever they can afford, so that they can claim the station as their own station. And this is an extremely exciting proposition, because St. Petersburg, Florida, while it is a rich city, when you look at the downtown St. Petersburg, it's kind of tourist city with beaches all around, and wealth very obvious in the white communities. The African community is an impoverished community, with something like 71% of the community living in or near poverty of black people. So it's talking about opening up all kinds of doors for ordinary black people who can expect to learn how to be on radio, how to engineer, how to do all of the things that's associated with broadcasting that otherwise would not have been something that was on their radar screen. So this is going to be an incredibly significant event. So we intend to be broadcasting early next year, and hoping that people will come out, and hoping that people will offer up whatever support they can give. I was in Harlem a couple of months ago and talked to a brother there who has been working for WBAI for a long period of time, and indicated that he has expertise that could be available to us. And I think there are other Africans who are out there who know how to run radio stations who are available, and we want them to join with us as well.
So what can people expect in terms of the format, the content of this station?
Well, one of the things that we want to do is we believe that a sharply defined format that deals with black issues, everything from every aspect of culture, from music. We're really interested in trying to impact on how music sounds coming from our community, the content of the music, and even anticipating being able to have shows that would rate local artists who could provide their CDs and require that these artists produce music for broadcasting that meet certain kind of criteria in terms of being positive and progressive as far as our community is concerned. We want people especially to be able to come here for culture music. We want to be the station where everybody who's interested in Caribbean and African sounds, this is where they would come to. And then, of course, the political content is going to be extremely important to us as well. We anticipate being able to run your commentaries on a regular basis, and other things having to do with editorially significant information. We're talking about being able even to teach people how to do gardening, etc. So there's going to be a heavy educational content, but the objective is not to just put something up that will meet some kind of ideological requirements of our movement, but to really speak to the aspirations and the interests of the community itself. And we expect a lot of young people to be involved. For example, there are at least two 16-year-old young women who we expect to play fundamentally important roles in defining what the show is going to sound like for young African people. And we are growing as a young organization, so it will have a dynamic and youthful content, serious cultural content. And by cultural, I don't mean necessarily something that is ideologically heavy in that way, but that can, where African people can be black and don't have to worry about the blackness of our culture being offensive and something that won't meet the requirements of some kind of corporate or liberal entity. A lot of this is still being shaped, but we expect to have a very dynamic radio program, radio station here, that will attract especially young people. And I put an emphasis on young people because the thing is that we have to define the future. And I think young people are always in the process of defining the future. And if we can bring young people who are also politically conscious, politically involved, then that's going to be a dynamic thing. And I think by virtue of attracting and involving a lot of young people, other people as well, but especially a lot of young people, I think we'll almost guarantee that the station will be an extraordinarily popular station here in the city.
In terms of who the station speaks to, how big is its broadcast radius? How far will the signal reach in the St. Petersburg, Tampa area?
The broadcast signal will reach the entire black community of St. Petersburg, Florida. It will reach the community of Gulfport, Florida, which is a neighboring city, the place where our 6th Congress was held. You were there in the city of Gulfport. It will reach that. It will reach the three universities in the area, Eckert College. It will reach St. Petersburg College. It will reach the university here. It will reach parts of downtown St. Petersburg. So it will reach the entire African community plus. And it's a very exciting prospect that we have here.
And what's the station going to call itself? What will the call letters be? W what?
Well, we've been playing with WFTP, which probably stands for Fight the Power, For the People, or something in that vein. But that's what we're looking at, WFTP. You know, we've got some really important forces that's going to be participating, some of whom you've met, Glenn, at different events that we've attended. But, you know, more than 90% of the airwaves are controlled by 6 corporations. And 90%, more than 90%. And for us to find a crack in this whole setup that we can begin to bring African sounds and African interests, that's incredibly important.
When the trial of former Chadian President Hissène Habré began this week in Dakar, Senegal, the judges and the guards treated the defendant like Bobby Seale at the Chicago 7 trial back in 1969. The 72-year-old Habré was carried into the courtroom by 4 guards and forced to sit still in his seat as he shouted mercenaries and scofflaws at the judges. It was much the same scene as back in July when the extraordinary African Chambers Court first attempted to try Habré for alleged crimes against humanity, torture, and war crimes. The former strong man yelled, "Down with imperialism," and denounced Senegalese politicians as African traitors and valets of America. Which is quite interesting because Hissène Habré used to be a client of America and a tool of U.S. imperialism himself between the years 1982 and 1990, when he's alleged to have committed all those crimes. Habré was a willing asset of both the United States and the French former colonial masters of Chad, who made good use of him in their proxy war against Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's government in the neighboring country of Libya. With the CIA's help, Habré managed to defeat Gaddafi's forces in the 1986 so-called Toyota War, and to kill 40,000 of his own countrymen in his vast political prison system, where another 200,000 were held and tortured. Habré served the Americans so well, Gaddafi gave up trying to influence events in Chad, leaving it to the Americans and Europeans. Soon, Hissène Habré was no longer needed, and in 1990 was overthrown by Idriss Déby, a warlord from an ethnic group that had suffered greatly under Habré. But nothing has changed in Chad except the name and the tribe of the puppet. The U.S. and France remain the real powers in charge. Needless to say, the United States and France are not sitting in the dock with Hissène Habré, who faces the consequences of their mutual crimes alone. Habré might have escaped judgment entirely had pressures for his arrest not caught up with him. The out-of-work warlord has spent most of the last 25 years in quiet exile in Senegal. The Belgians had claimed universal jurisdiction to prosecute him. But what kind of justice would that have been, given that the king of Belgium killed as many as 12 million Congolese and countless other Africans during the colonial period? The Senegalese refused to hand Habré over to the Belgians. Then, in 2010, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, asked the African Union to create a special tribunal to try Habré. In 2013, Habré was arrested. The extraordinary African Chambers Court is thought by some to be a test of whether Africa can dispense justice to its own current and former politicians. But I think the question is posed incorrectly. Africa is full of presidents that have killed and imprisoned their own people, most of them while working as agents and mercenaries for U.S. imperialism, the main source of the crime wave. Until the American, British, and French are made to sit in the dock with the Hissein Habrés of the continent, there can be no justice.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.